On Mondays, we read from your letters, and first, a couple of corrections. There was a mistake in our segment on fat and foods. We said Subway offers several sandwiches with less than 3 grams of fat. Jim Palmer emailed us with a correction. The Subway napkin on my desk, he said, indicates 7 subs with 6 grams of fat or less, not the 3 grams you stated. Thanks, Jim. And during our show on elderly drivers, we interviewed Kathy Freund, president and executive director of the Independent Transportation Network. We mistakenly said the organization is in Portland, Oregon. It's actually in Portland, Maine. You can find more information about the Independent Transportation Network online at itninc.org. And during that same program on older drivers, many of you wrote in with your own stories. This from Jay Frazier. In Pennsylvania, we're able to anonymously report impaired drivers, and I did have to do this with my father. He has Parkinson's disease, and his license was rescinded about a year and a half ago. He was walking with the use of a walker, and his balance and reaction times were not good. My father still talks about his driving ability being better than the people he sees on the road. It's a long process to acceptance, I feel, though, that I made a very wise decision. Carol Ash of Meeker, Oklahoma writes, "My father gave up driving a few years ago at the age of 75. He did this voluntarily because he knew he was a danger to others as well as to himself. I think it's up to each of us as drivers to know when to give up the keys, and we must be honest with ourselves and recognize limitations or seek the opinions of others about our driving habits." A different view from April Murray of St. Louis, Missouri. "An older driver has a horrific accident, and now older drivers are going to be the objects of witch hunts," she writes. "More teenagers kill themselves, friends, and innocents every day, and I don't see them being targeted. Let's get all bad drivers off the road. I fear being killed by a DWI driver more than the little old lady from Pasadena." And during our program on mosquitoes, we received a lot of questions and comments that we didn't have time to address, so we've invited Colonel Dan Strickman back. He's the chief of the Department of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland, and thanks for rejoining us.
You're welcome.
Colonel Strickland, I'd like to start out with some questions of technique to drive away the mosquito. This one from Stacy Donovan of Lawrence, Kansas. "My mother-in-law bought this machine that supposedly hums like a male mosquito to keep away the females. Is this possible?"
Well, if the sound is accurate, it might attract mosquitoes, but it's certainly not going to stop them from biting.
Brian in Berkeley, California wrote in to ask about vitamin B2. Does that have repellent effect?
Well, studies have shown that it does decrease the number of biting mosquitoes, but it's not nearly as effective as using a regular commercial repellent.
Something like DEET?
Something like DEET, yes.
Here's one I particularly like from Mark Westbrook of Spokane. "It was believed by my camping buddies that drinking beer, especially strong homemade beer, reduced the risk of mosquito bites. I think it was the hops that did the trick. Any truth to that, or does drinking just make us care less about the annoyance?"
Well, I don't know about that, but if beer cured mosquito bites, nobody would get any.
What about the mosquito's natural enemies? Does it have any, and can we promote their growth?
Well, a mosquito's life is a very dangerous one. All the way from being a larva in the water to an adult, there are germs and creatures trying to eat them and make them sick and kill them. So if a female mosquito lays a couple of hundred eggs in her lifetime, on average, only 2 of those will survive to reproduce.
That's too many.
That's too many, absolutely.
One final question from Matt Davidson in Los Angeles. "Why is it that mosquitoes seem to be worse the further north one goes? Other insects seem to get worse in warmer climates, but with mosquitoes, by the time one gets to Alaska, the joke is that they're the state bird."
Well, there certainly are a lot up north, and I think a couple of things are going on. One is that when you get into harsh environments, there tend to be outbreaks with large numbers of insects. And that's true of many different kinds of insects. And then the other thing is there isn't much food up there for insects other than blood from large groups of animals like caribou and the birds that are so abundant up there.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Colonel Dan Strickman is chief of the Department of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland.
They talk about mosquitoes in Alaska being big. Old-timers tell their stories and exaggerate a bit. Well, you may not believe me, but I swear that I did see a mosquito straight from hell that towered over 6'3".
Mosquito Showdown by Lou Nathanson. One last item. Last week we spoke with author Aaron Napperstack about hunkus, using haiku to relieve road rage. We forgot to mention that you can read portions of Aaron's book and hear NPR voices reading some hunkus when you go to our website, www.npr.org. We read from your letters every Monday. Send your emails to us at totn@npr.org. Don't forget to put the topic in the subject line and give us a hint if we need it on how to pronounce your name and where you live. My thanks to Lynn Neary for filling in on vacation. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.